Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 136. It's Monday, November 1st. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Welcome to flu season, which of course is also COVID-19 season. We've been lucky that cases have come down, but they are still, that is, the COVID-19 transmission rates are now at a rate much higher than we were at the beginning of last flu season or COVID-19 season. So there's still more to come. Well, I didn't do a local update last week, so let's do the local update now. 2 weeks worth of data. Okay, well, over the last 2 weeks, we did have a decline in local average daily number of cases, down from 162 to 121. That's good. In Ohio, we now only have 87 out of 88 Ohio counties in the high transmission rate. One Appalachian county moved down to just substantial transmission. We are still in the thick of it. Testing positivity rates are terrible, but going down. In Lucas County, it's 10.1%. Still trying to get down to that under 5 goal. The testing volume is steadily going down. We're still higher than the state testing positivity rate, which is went down to 9% from 10.6% 2 weeks ago. The testing volume statewide is also going down rather steadily. But unfortunately, Ohio is not doing nearly as well as the U.S. as a whole. The testing positivity rate for the United States as a whole is 5.1%, getting very close to that under 5% goal for something that represents adequate testing. But of course, the epidemic varies very much by region, and Ohio, being the heart of it all, also is in the thick of it for the COVID-19 epidemic. Okay, well, cases continue to decline, active cases, that is, in long-term care facilities and nursing homes. We went down to 26 active cases in the most recent week reported from 41 2 weeks earlier. That's 11 residents with active cases and 15 staff. And good news, we didn't have any more deaths reported in long-term care facilities. In Lucas County schools, we see a slow but steady decline in the number of staff and students that have had cases. In Lucas County, we've had 168 students test positive and 39 staff in the most recent week of reporting. That's down somewhat from a couple weeks ago when we had 238 students and 35 staff. So a slight tick up in staff and a substantial decline in students. This is not too much different than the rate that we see in the state as a whole. Statewide, there were 3,406 students testing positive and 618 staff. Okay, well, back locally with the University of Toledo, they've been holding steady around the high 30s or 40s as far as the number of cases identified each week. In the most recent week, they had 45 UT students test positive. That includes 4 that tested positive during their random surveillance testing, which is a 0.5% positivity rate, not too bad. That seems to be holding relatively steady as they're moving towards the November 15th date when UT is mandating proof of vaccines or students must submit to weekly testing. Okay, hospitalizations have gone down in the last couple of weeks in Lucas County and Ohio, but appear to be leveling off somewhat. This seems to be what I see coming here as we enter flu season, is it seems like we've probably hit our low for cases and hospitalizations and deaths. That's going to turn around and start ticking back up as flu season, COVID-19 season hits. Okay, deaths are falling nationally, but we're still having over 1,100 deaths each day on average. Lucas County has reported 32 deaths over the last 2 weeks. This is very, very high from what we've had in recent months and months. Okay, well, to vaccinations. For those that are fully vaccinated in the nation as a whole, we have 58% of our total population that has been fully vaccinated. In Ohio, that's 51.8%, and in Lucas County, it's 50.4%. We did crack the majority mark in the last couple weeks here. Okay, well, but probably the important thing as far as trends is while people continue to get vaccinated, the rates are still becoming less and less every week, more than you'd expect from just having less people to vaccinate. Still slowing down. Okay, well, let's get to some more COVID-19 news. There's still a lot happening as we learn more and more as we go along through this pandemic. This from Medical Express. COVID vaccines 5 times more effective at preventing COVID-related hospitalization than prior infection alone. More reason to get vaccinated. If you think that prior infection is going to protect you, it's much more of a risk. A nationwide study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that mRNA COVID-19 vaccines are associated with significantly more immunity than prior COVID-19 infection. The research team found that overall, unvaccinated adults with a previous COVID-19 infection were about 5 times more likely to be hospitalized than those who were vaccinated. The data analysis also found among adults older than 65, overall mRNA vaccines were nearly 20 times more effective at preventing hospitalizations than prior infection alone. The study findings are consistent with laboratory evidence that mRNA vaccines create high levels of antibodies, whereas those who recover from COVID-19 have varying levels of antibodies, especially if they experience mild symptoms or were asymptomatic. Well, folks, the COVID-19 3.0, meaning the Delta variant, has really been pushing through and finding that additional vaccinations and boosters and stuff, or getting, obviously, vaccination from just natural infection seems to help a lot. This from Medical Express. Largest real-world study of third dose of COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness shows Delta resistance. The Clalit Research Institute, in collaboration with researchers from Harvard University, analyzed one of the world's largest integrated health record databases to examine the effectiveness of the third dose of the Pfizer vaccine against the Delta variant. The study provides the largest peer-reviewed evaluation of the effectiveness of a third booster dose of COVID-19 vaccines in a nationwide mass vaccination setting. The study was conducted in Israel. It is published in The Lancet Journal. The results show that, compared with individuals who received only 2 doses 5 months prior, individuals with 3 doses of the vaccine 7 days or more after the third dose had 93% lower risk of COVID-19 related hospitalization, 92% lower risk of severe COVID-19 disease, and 81% lower risk of COVID-19 related death. Vaccine effectiveness was found to be similar for different sexes, age groups, and number of comorbidities. Now, the important thing is here, this is comparing people with a third dose to those who'd had the 2 doses, which, of course, is considered to be completely vaccinated, provided a lot more protection. Frankly, I've been a little bit skeptical about how essential the booster shots were. I think this puts to rest that the fact that booster shots, particularly now that we're ending flu season, is very, very important. And, of course, besides the hospitalization and death factor, is that we do, even if it's temporary over a period of weeks or months, to get a nice little rise in antibodies that can also prevent infections, both for yourself and for those around you. Okay, but of course, those infections do, in fact, still happen. This from Medical Express. COVID-19 vaccines lower risk of infection with Delta variant, but infection can still be passed on in household settings. People who have received two vaccine doses against COVID-19 have a lower but still appreciable risk of becoming infected with the Delta variant compared with unvaccinated people. Vaccinated people clear the infection more quickly, but the peak viral load among vaccinated people is similar to that seen in unvaccinated people, which may explain why they can still readily pass on the virus in household settings, according to a study published in The Lancet Infectious Diseases. Professor Ajit Lalvani of Imperial College London, UK, who co-led the study, said that vaccines are critical to controlling the pandemic. As we know, they are very effective at preventing serious illness and death from COVID-19. However, our findings show that vaccination alone is not enough to prevent people from being infected with the Delta variant and spreading it in household settings. The ongoing transmission we are seeing between vaccinated people makes it essential for unvaccinated people to get vaccinated to protect themselves from acquiring infection and severe COVID-19, especially as more people will be spending time inside in close proximity during the winter months. We found that susceptibility to infection increased already within a few months after the second vaccine dose, so those eligible for COVID-19 booster shots should get them promptly. And after a long hiatus, let's hear from Corey.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, while COVID-19 infections are still plugging along, we have some good news. This from Medical Express. Severe COVID-19 outcomes not up during Delta predominance. During a period of Delta variant predominance, there was no increase in the proportion of patients who were admitted to an intensive care unit, received invasive mechanical ventilation, or died while hospitalized, according to research published in the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Okay, well, another good news, that is at least for the vaccinated, this from Medical Express. Mortality study reinforces safety of COVID-19 vaccinations. COVID-19 vaccine recipients had lower non-COVID-19 death rates than people who weren't vaccinated, according to a Kaiser Permanente research published in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Despite numerous studies showing the safety of COVID-19 vaccines, some people have remained hesitant to get vaccinated, said lead author Stanley Zhu of the Kaiser Permanente Southern California Department of Research and Evaluation. This study provides reassurance that the vaccines are very safe, and in fact, people who received COVID-19 vaccine in the United States had a lower death rate than those who didn't, even if you don't count COVID-19 deaths. To determine mortality risk associated with COVID-19 vaccination, researchers evaluated electronic health records of 6.4 million COVID-19 vaccine recipients, compared to 4.6 million unvaccinated people with similar demographics and geographic locations, from December 14, 2020 through July 31, 2021. The study looked at only non-COVID-19 related deaths. To avoid masking any safety concerns regarding COVID-19 vaccine related death with the protective effects of COVID-19 vaccine. So, For the Pfizer and Moderna COVID-19 vaccine recipients had a mortality rate of 3.6 deaths per 100,000 vaccinated people. This was compared to the unvaccinated comparison group, which had a mortality rate of 11.1 deaths per 1,000 people per year. That's 3.6 deaths for the mRNA vaccinated group and the unvaccinated 11.1. That's about three times higher. A little bit different for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine recipients. They had a death rate of 8.4 per 100 per 1,000 people compared to the reference group of unvaccinated at 14.7 deaths, so almost two times. But this is really stunning, actually, and there must be some confounders in here because clearly I don't think the COVID-19 vaccine makes you that much healthier. There's probably some confounders in the sense that people that are likely to get vaccinated are more concerned about their health, perhaps some access issues for those people that are not so much vaccine skeptical, but have just not gotten around to it for, you know, don't want to get sick to take time off work, don't have leave, that kind of thing. But this is very stunning and probably the final piece of evidence that for anybody who thinks that the vaccine skeptics or those who have found some kind of hidden key to good health, they have not. But of course, conspiracies will continue. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, some good news in that the different layers of protection we can employ to protect us from COVID-19, we have this from Medical Express. Air purification study finds 45% reduction in healthcare-associated infections, including COVID. A new scientific study published this month in the Journal of Hospital Infection finds cutting-edge air purification technology installed at St. Mary's Hospital for Children reduced healthcare-associated infections, including COVID, by 45%. The study, which took place over a three-year period and was already underway when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, is thought to be the first of its kind, examining the impact of advanced air purification technology in a real-world hospital setting. The study results provide a window into the significant advances that could be made in reducing the transmission of airborne viruses and bacteria in hospitals. According to the CDC, hospital-associated infections account for an estimated 1.7 million infections and 99,000 associated deaths each year. Beyond hospitals, the findings point to a proven solution for reducing the spread of COVID-19 in other indoor settings such as schools, restaurants, and commercial office buildings, where the risk of transmitting the virus is the highest. Okay, to back up to a little bit bigger picture, let's do some little bit of news from around the world and also evidence that this pandemic is still raging on. This from Medical Express. Russia marks another daily coronavirus death high. Russia hit another record for daily COVID-19 deaths as authorities across the country moved to keep most people off work in line with a Kremlin order aimed at stemming the spread. The government has blamed the soaring contagion and deaths on the slow pace of vaccination. Only about a third of the country's nearly 146 million people are fully vaccinated. And of course, vaccine skepticism is the highest in the world in Russia, and we come in close behind that. Okay, well, throughout the pandemic, we've had a lot of information, and I've reported a fair amount on mental health outcomes related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, here is a very good study that shows that maybe it isn't as bad as some of us may have feared. And I've been looking very closely at non-COVID-19 direct morbidity and mortality, and this is some good news from Medical Express. Despite review indicates mental health resilience during COVID-19 pandemic. Despite a significant but small increase in mental health symptoms early on in the COVID-19 pandemic, overall there was great resilience in mental health during 2020, University of Liverpool researchers have found. These findings cast doubt on the assumption that there has been a tsunami of mental health problems as a result of the pandemic. A large-scale review of 65 studies published in the Journal of Affective Disorders shows that by mid-2020, mental health symptoms were comparable to pre-pandemic levels. However, there were larger rises for depressive symptoms, and those with existing poor physical health may have been most affected. Corresponding author Dr. Eric Robinson said, "Our research has drawn conclusion that which go against the idea that there has been a mental health crisis during the pandemic in the general population or those with existing mental health conditions. The results, in fact, show how remarkably resilient people's mental health has tended to be after the very early initial shock of the pandemic. Primary meta-analysis of predominantly European and North American studies showed that there was a statistically small overall increase in mental health symptoms. The increase in mental health symptoms was largest among studies that sampled participants in the early stages of the pandemic, that is, March through April of 2020. The severity of the mental health symptoms decreased significantly over the following months, May of 2020 through July of 2020. The research team suggests that this pattern of results may represent an acute and normal response to an unforeseen and distressing traumatic event, which was then followed by a period of psychological adaptation and resilience. There was no evidence of worsening of mental health symptoms among samples of participants with a pre-existing mental health condition. Dr. Eric Robinson said, "Our analysis suggests that overall there has been considerable resilience in mental health. Current data on recorded suicides align with this, as there has tended to be stable rates or decreases reported across a number of countries. However, there is a need for continued mental health provision, monitoring of mental health, particularly during periods of increased COVID-19 infection and death. Long-term investment in mental health service will also be valuable. The increase in depression and mood disorder symptoms that did not return to pre-pandemic levels warrants attention, and even a small upward shift in depressive symptoms may have meaningful cumulative consequences on the population level." So, good news for the population as a whole, but of course, there are some subpopulations that, of course, we need to worry a little bit more about. This from Medical Express. People who purchase guns during buying surge more likely to have suicidal thoughts. People who purchase firearms during the 2020-2021 purchasing surge, particularly first-time buyers, were more likely to have thoughts of suicide, according to a Rutgers study. The researchers surveyed 6,404 adults from New Jersey, Minnesota, and Mississippi and found that surge purchasers were more likely than other firearm owners and non-firearm owners to report suicidal thoughts during their lifetime, the previous year, and the previous month. Although firearm access is associated with a risk for suicide, the study found that first-time firearm owners who purchased a gun during this period were more likely than established firearm owners to report lifetime and past year suicidal ideation. According to the study, about 6% of U.S. residents purchased a firearm between March 2020 and mid-July 2020. Of these, 34% were first-time buyers, a rate higher than typical. The states in the study were chosen due to their difference in geography, demographics, political climate, firearm ownership rates, firearm purchasing laws, gun violence rates, and culture. The Rutgers study found that 56% of surge purchasers have experienced lifetime suicidal thoughts compared to 32% of non-firearm owners and 28% of other firearm owners. Over the past year, 42% of surge purchasers reported suicidal thoughts versus 23% of non-firearm owners and 18% of other firearm owners. Also, 20% of surge purchasers reported suicidal thoughts in the past month compared to only 11% of non-firearm owners and 7% of other firearm owners. Almost 40% of these buyers store at least one firearm unlocked. Okay, well, we know that overall, guns actually kill more people who kill themselves than kill other people. So suicide is a very important issue when we're talking about gun access. And in this case, buying them and owning them. Of course, suicidal thoughts range far and wide in our society. Hone in on one area, this from Medical Express. Nurses think about suicide more than other workers. Mayo Clinic researchers report that nurses in the U.S. experience suicidal ideation in greater numbers than other general workers, and those who do are less likely to tell anyone about it. The findings appear in the American Journal of Nursing. It's important to note that this survey was conducted beginning in late 2017 with data collection in 2018, before any of these nurses were confronted with the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. While the findings of our study are serious enough, we recognize the impact of the current pandemic has dramatically compounded the situation, says Lizalette Dryby, a Mayo Clinic internist and a senior author. The need for system-level interventions to improve the work lives of nurses and other members of the healthcare team is greater than ever before. Okay, well, let's get to some non-COVID public health news. This from Medical Express. U.S. cites crisis as road deaths rise 18% in first half of 2021. The number of U.S. traffic deaths in the first 6 months of 2021 hit 20,160, the highest first half total since 2006. A government reported last Thursday, a sign of growing reckless driving during the coronavirus pandemic. The estimated number was 18.4% higher than the first half of last year, prompting Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg to call the increase an unacceptable crisis. That percentage increase was the biggest 6 months increase since the department began recording fatal crash data since 1975. The department, which includes the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, announced that it will develop a national strategy for steps to save lives on the road. We cannot and should not accept these fatalities as simply part of everyday life in America, Buttigieg said in a statement. No one will accomplish this alone. It will take all levels of government, industries, advocates, engineers, and communities across the country working together toward the day when family members no longer have to say goodbye to loved ones because of a traffic crash. The National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration also said that behavioral research from March through June showed that speeding and traveling without a seatbelt remain higher than before the pandemic. The agency has pointed to increasing road deaths, a trend for the last 2 years, on more reckless behavior on the roads. The latest spike in fatalities came as people drove more as pandemic shutdowns eased. Preliminary data from the Federal Highway Administration showed that vehicle miles traveled in the first 6 months of the year rose by 173 billion miles, around a 13% increase from last year. The death rate for the first half of this year rose to 1.34 per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. It's up from 1.28 deaths per 100 million miles in the first half of 2020, the agency said. Okay, well, this is actually a really good case study on both science reporting and some basic principles of data in public health. There is, in fact, some truth to this story, but it's a little bit overblown. We know that 2020 and 2021 were not normal years. The pandemic hit in the second half of the first half of last year, and traffic, the amount of traffic that that miles traveled went way down. And then, of course, it went up like 13% from 2020 to 2021 in the first half of those 2 years. Now, of course, road deaths rose 18%. So there you go. It's about 50% higher. That's significant, but not quite as striking as the headline would have it. So if you look at the absolute number of people killed, these are real people, you have an 18.4% increase in the number of total deaths. But if you look at it as a rate, which is what you really have to look at if you're comparing, like, for instance, are drivers crazy or less safe or this type of thing, there was a 5% increase in the rate per miles driven when you adjust for the amount of miles that were driven. Now, that's significant, but it's not quite as dramatic as the 18.4%. And of course, these are two very important statistics. You want to count the actual number of real people. But when you're comparing different situations, the rate, as they have like per 100 million miles traveled, is a more fairer comparison when they're making all these claims about, you know, a whole bunch more deaths because of speeding or traveling without seatbelts. So it looks like there's something there, but not quite as large as the headline would show. Okay, well, you're listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about some environmental justice and environmental health issues here. This from The Nation. Environmental justice is essential in the workplace and at home. No worker should be forced to choose between an unsafe job and unemployment. It is now widely recognized that communities of color in the United States are far more likely than their white counterparts to be exposed to pollution and toxic waste in their neighborhood. Black and brown residents of these communities disproportionately suffer from the health effects of these harmful exposures, from children with asthma to seniors with cancer. Driven by the movement for racial justice, the Biden administration has rightly made addressing these environmental inequities a policy priority. However, there is another crucial aspect of environmental and racial justice that has not gained the same recognition: environmental justice in the workplace. Injustices in the work environment, including toxic chemicals, unguarded machines, working unprotected at heights or in extreme heat, and now COVID-19, are as dangerous as those outside the factory fence. Black and brown workers are more likely to be exposed to workplace hazards than white workers, and as a result are at greater risk of injury, illness, and death. In fact, racial discrimination in jobs, with workers of color forced to take the most hazardous positions with the fewest labor protections, has been a fundamental and immutable characteristic of employment relations in this nation since its foundation as a slave republic in 1776, one that has continued through Jim Crow and into the post-industrial era. The COVID-19 pandemic has revealed just how little this has changed. As members of the overwhelmingly white office-based workforce have been able to telework safely in their homes, black and brown workers were overrepresented among the workers in essential industries who have risked their health and their lives caring for our ill and elderly, ensuring our grocery stores were well-stocked, and that public transportation functioned. As a result, working-age adults of color died at COVID at much higher rates than white workers. We believe that if the predominantly white-collar workforce had been required to leave home and go to the office from the start of the pandemic and had faced the same risks as meat factory or farm workers, the government and the nation's employers would have quickly prioritized reducing workplace exposures to COVID-19. Even before COVID hit, jobs that had been characterized as essential were among the most dangerous jobs in the country. The repetitive cutting required of beef, pork, and poultry slaughterhouse workers destroys shoulders and arms. Nursing home and hospital workers who frequently must lift heavy patients actually have higher injury rates than construction workers or coal miners. Farm workers perform difficult labor, often in high heat, unprotected from pesticide exposure. Temporary workers employed in many dangerous industries are more likely to be non-white and are at greater risk of injury than those with permanent jobs. Given all this, it is not surprising that black and brown workers are far more likely than white workers to have a work-related disability. On top of exposure to these dangers, many workers of color also suffer from systemic racism in their workplace, a hazard as toxic as the chemicals they breathe on the shop floor. In effect, workplace racism weakens the basic requirements for safe workplaces for all workers of all races, endangering the health and safety of everyone. If a home builder can exploit immigrant, unauthorized workers of color who are afraid to complain about unsafe conditions or apply for workers' compensation when they are injured, or if a meat processing firm employs refugees who are willing to accept unacceptably hazardous work, those employers will be able to avoid hiring workers who demand better, safer conditions. Unfortunately, the tools currently available to fix these problems are inadequate and badly need reform. The labor movement has been weakened, and only a small percentage of private sector workers are unionized. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, charged with requiring employers to keep workplaces safe, is underfunded and unable to provide proper, vigorous oversight. Workplace injuries and illnesses contribute to our economic inequality crisis, sending middle-class workers into poverty and keeping many poor people from joining the middle class altogether. The workers' compensation system, meant to help those hurt on the job, often provides no compensation at all, or payments that do not come close to replacing lost income or covering medical expenses. Equity and justice in the workplace do not mean raising up the conditions of workers of color to be on equal footing as white workers if the workplace environment exposes all workers to unnecessary risk of injury and inadequate compensation. No worker should be forced to choose between an unsafe job and unemployment. Equity and justice in the workplace require strengthening labor protections for all workers, so employers can no longer get away with not investing in making jobs safe by exploiting people of color, unauthorized and/or temporary workers. Federal law needs to be changed to make it easier for workers to join unions. OSHA and other government agencies must be given greater resources and greater authority to focus on eliminating hazards in the most dangerous workplaces where workers of color are overrepresented. And it means reforming the workers' compensation system so injured workers get full replacement for lost income. The environmental justice movement has long affirmed the right of all workers, regardless of race, to a safe and healthy work environment. All workers need good, safe jobs that enable them to support their families. Within the Biden administration's vital efforts on environmental and racial justice, workplace environmental justice must be made a high priority.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, and news from food politics. The European Green New Deal, farm-to-fork strategy. The European Parliament has just ratified the European Commission's farm-to-fork draft action plan for a fair, healthy, and environmentally friendly food system. This was based on previous reports and research. The European Parliament approved the action plan despite having to deal with a lobbying blitz from meat producers. Another industry body objects to the scapegoating of ultra-processed foods in the action plan. As is almost always the case with such plans, there are so many proposals in the just-approved action plan that it is hard to sort out what is important. There is plenty here to challenge food companies. For example, directive to significantly reduce use and risk and dependency on pesticides and enhance integrated pest management. Evaluation and revision of the existing animal welfare legislation, including animal transport and slaughter of animals. Proposal for a revision of the feed additives regulation to reduce the environmental impact of livestock farming. An initiative to improve the corporate governance framework, including a requirement for the food industry to integrate sustainability into corporate strategies. Set nutrient profiles to restrict promotion of food high in salt, sugars, and/or fat. Proposal for a harmonized mandatory front-of-pack nutrition labeling to enable consumers to make health-conscious food choices. Proposal for a sustainable food labeling framework to empower consumers to make sustainable food choices. Review of the EU school scheme legal framework with a view to refocus the scheme on healthy and sustainable food. And I must admit, I can't avoid an editorial comment that I love the idea that when you're talking about school food, the term EU comes up. And Marion Nestle, the author of Food Politics, concludes with, could we do something like these, please? Okay, and a more personal health note, this from Medical Express. For effective weight maintenance, eat breakfast and stop late-night snacking. Researchers have confirmed that due to daily circadian rhythms regulating metabolism, when you eat is as important as how much and what you eat when trying to gain, lose, or maintain weight. If you do an enforced fast, the subjects did gain a little less weight, but not restricting access to food does not cause as much extra weight gain as we originally thought. About 80% of the benefit of eating larger meals at the beginning of the day is present even if you do not have an enforced fast. This novel research shows that timing of meals is important for weight maintenance regardless of fasting. This is important because as humans, most of us have access to food 24/7. So try not to eat food late in the day or for several hours before you go to sleep. Okay, and switching gears again, this from Stat News. A new index measures the extent and depth of addiction stigma. Addiction stigma is a set of unfair, negative, and often discriminatory beliefs directed towards individuals with substance use disorders. These views can erode their self-worth, create social isolation, and reduce access to care, which exacerbates the problem. It also clouds the nation's ability to coalesce around meaningful solutions, including treatment, harm reduction, and recovery supports and services. In 2020 alone, more than 93,000 people in the U.S. died from overdoses, the highest number ever recorded. Addressing this epidemic during a global pandemic is extraordinarily challenging. COVID-19 has worsened the crisis by increasing economic precarity, imposing social isolation, and reducing access to treatment and recovery services. Structural racism and health inequities pose additional burdens that have contributed to addictions and overdoses nationwide. There are a number of ways to make real progress in the fight against addiction. One of them is confronting the inescapable fact that the stigma and discrimination associated with substance use disorders are making the crisis more difficult to overcome. Despite decades of action from nonprofits, healthcare providers, those with lived experience, and government agencies, stigma remains one of the most significant and persistent drivers of negative outcomes for people with substance use disorders. It propagates a disease, creating barriers to treatment, harm reduction, and recovery supports and services. Stigma can't be eradicated without reliably measuring and monitoring it. Yet there have been few mechanisms for regularly assessing levels of stigma or progress in combating it. To address this gap, Shatterproof, Indiana University, market firm Ipsos, and The Hartford, an insurance company, developed the Shatterproof Addiction Stigma Index to establish a baseline measure of public attitudes and beliefs about substance use disorders, and to monitor stigma related to them over time. The index also measures the perceptions of people with substance use disorders, including experiences of social exclusion and internalized stigma. With a comprehensive set of more than 50 measures of stigma, completed by a representative sample of nearly 8,000 U.S. residents, this is the largest and most expansive survey on addiction stigma ever fielded. By establishing a benchmark for future measurement, it will provide a robust tool to gauge progress and hold Shatterproof and national leaders accountable for results. Findings from the index have revealed that levels of stigma toward individuals in long-term recovery from heroin addiction are more negative than attitudes towards those with active addictions to prescription opioids. The Addiction Stigma Index contains three separate indices. One measures public attitudes and beliefs about people with substance use disorders, public stigma. Another measures institutional discrimination against people with substance use disorders through laws and policies, that is, structural stigma. The third measures feelings of self-devaluation and internalized stigma experienced by people with substance use disorders, that is, self-stigma. Prior research suggests that these three components manifest in different ways and may present disparate barriers to treatment and recovery supports and services. For this reason, measuring all three provides a more comprehensive insight into stigma than focusing on only one. The survey has already revealed useful and worrisome insights. For example, it extends findings from prior smaller studies by demonstrating that 3/4 of respondents consider someone with an active substance use disorder to be untrustworthy. Even individuals in long-term recovery are met with suspicion. More than one-third of respondents reported being unwilling to move next door to a person in recovery or to have them as a friend. And more than half said they would be unwilling to have someone in recovery marry into their family. Most distressing, fewer than one-quarter of respondents view addiction as a chronic disease. Responses among healthcare professionals are especially alarming, given their ability to directly affect access to care and the quality of care, and thus health outcomes of people with substance use disorders. The survey showed that levels of public and structural stigma in this group are similar to those in the general population. Healthcare professionals' limited knowledge about medications for opioid use disorder and stigmatizing views towards them is appalling. Among healthcare professionals surveyed, nearly half endorsed the harmful belief that treating opioid use disorder with medications for it, like buprenorphine or methadone, is simply, quote, substituting one drug for another. Addiction-related stigma has also allowed to fester in the U.S. far too long. It has infiltrated institutions and public perceptions, divided communities, and erected barriers to health and recovery that people with substance use disorders want and deserve. The country has an opportunity and an obligation to chart a new path informed by rigorous research and data, and to dismantle the discrimination and misinformation that threatens recovery. Okay, next up from Medical Express. Study could be key to addressing troubling causes of maternal mortality in U.S. According to a recent report from the Commonwealth Fund, the U.S. has nearly double the number of maternal deaths per 100,000 live births compared to other wealthy developed nations. Most maternal mortality research has been focused specifically on pregnancy complications as the cause of death, a subset of all deaths of pregnant or recently pregnant women. The team examined death certificates obtained from the CDC from the last 5 years to determine trends in mortality rates in pregnant and recently pregnant women. In total, 9,532 pregnant or recently pregnant women died from 2015 to 2019. The mortality rate for all causes increased significantly, an increase of 4.4% per year. There was a large increase in drug and alcohol-related deaths, a 17.4% annual increase over 5 years. This speaks to a much larger problem than issues of pregnancy complications and lack of medical care. This now becomes a bigger social and societal issue involving substance abuse and violence against women that requires a completely different set of solutions. These deaths of despair also increased at a much faster rate in pregnant women than in women in general. So now this opens up the discussion of why. Why is it that so many pregnant and recently pregnant women are overdosing? Another troubling statistic is the increased mortality rate from homicides. From 2015 to 2019, homicides of pregnant and recently pregnant women increased by 13.5% per year. Okay, troubling news, but let's put in a little bit of better news here. This from Medical Express. Fetal mortality drops to a historic low of 5.7 per 1,000 in 2019. The fetal mortality rate at 20 or more weeks of gestation in the United States was 5.7 per 1,000 live births, or fetal deaths in 2019, down 3% from 2018, according to the National Vital Statistics Report, a publication of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The fetal mortality rate was highest for non-Hispanic, Black, and Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islander women, around 10 in 2019, and it was lowest for non-Hispanic Asian women at 4. The highest fetal mortality rates were seen for women aged 40 years and older, women who smoked during pregnancy, and those with multiple gestation pregnancies, which means twins, triplets, and the like. Okay, this next story gets at one of my pet peeves at kind of reductionistic science and medicine, and also in using statistics, just looking at associations rather than determining actual causality. Here we go from Stat News. The vast majority of genes have been tied to cancer, and that can complicate research. Yao Pedro de Magalhães scours the human genome for clues that might help us understand why people age and what we might do to stop that. Without fail, each time he's done one of these studies, nearly every gene ends up having some kind of link to cancer. The University of Liverpool researchers started to wonder just how many human genes are associated with cancer and set about doing an analysis of genetic papers on the online medical archive PubMed. Of the 17,371 human genes studied at one point or another in papers in the archive, the vast majority have some connection to cancer. I was surprised by how strong the effects are. Nearly 90% of genes are associated with cancer. So, of course, if everything's associated with something, it's meaningless. It's kind of like saying, well, you know, the vast majority of people who have liver cancer have livers. It's kind of like, you know, the vast majority of people with cancer have genes. I think it just really speaks to also some of the funding things is people want to say that they're studying something, you know, really tied to something important. Cancer, of course, is something very important. But sometimes in the small silos of research, this just ends up little eddies of reductionistic research that don't actually result in improved health in the human population. Just another pet peeve of mine. Okay, well, let's end our news segment with some good news and something that resonates deep in the heart of my public health soul. This from the World Health Organization. Investing $1 per person per year in hand hygiene could save hundreds of thousands of lives. All households in the world's 46 least developed countries could have hand washing facilities by 2030 if the world invested less than $1 per person per year in hand hygiene. That would provide basic protection against diseases, avert future outbreaks, and prevent hundreds of thousands of deaths. The 2021 State of the World's Hand Hygiene Report, launched by the World Health Organization and UNICEF, highlights that an annual cost of governments of promoting hand washing with soap at home comes to just 2.5 cents on 2.5% of the average government health expenditure in these countries, making it a highly cost-effective investment, providing outsized health benefits for relatively little cost. Hand hygiene, one of the first lines of defense against the spread of infectious diseases, remains out of reach for billions of people who still lack hand hygiene facilities at home, school, or healthcare facilities. Globally, 3 in 10 people, or 2.3 billion people, lack a hand washing facility with water and soap at home. 818 million children lack a hand washing facility with soap and water at school. And health workers in 1 in 3 healthcare facilities lack hand hygiene facilities at the point at which they provide care. That is astounding. Placing them all at preventable risk of disease, even at the best of times. Almost 2 billion people depend on healthcare facilities that don't even have basic water services. Achieving the goal of universal access to hand hygiene will require dramatic change of gear. The current average pace of progress would have to quadruple to ensure all homes in the world have this access. The same applies to universal access to hand hygiene services in schools by 2030, which will also require at least a fourfold increase in the current average rate of progress, with greater acceleration needed in some areas. If current rates of progress continue, by 2030, the world will have reached only 78% coverage of basic hygiene services, leaving 1.9 billion people without the facilities to wash their hands at home. Hand hygiene is truly no regrets investment. Our estimates show that for every dollar invested, countries can save $15. Wow, the wonders of public health. But the rates of access to hand hygiene facilities remain stubbornly low. With some notable exceptions, few countries have made significant efforts to tackle the need for hand hygiene in public places, for example, said Bruce Gordon, head of the Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene Unit at the World Health Organization. Government should commit to hand hygiene not just as a temporary public health intervention in times of crisis, but as a vital, everyday behavior that contributes to health and economic resilience. Where else but public health can you invest $1 and get a 15-time return? Okay, well, you can re-listen to this broadcast or look at the actual full articles that I've often edited down in this news report. And I've got 10 bonus articles this week that you can view online, and I will give the URL after I list the 10 articles. So up first, number one, stop the false narrative about young children and COVID. They need vaccines. Two, how worried should we be about the new COVID AY.4.2 lineage of the coronavirus? Three, COVID-19 cases, deaths, and meatpacking industry were much higher than previously known, congressional investigation shows. 4. What you need to know about getting the COVID-19 vaccine if you're undocumented. 5. America's food safety system failed to stop a salmonella epidemic. It's still making people sick. 6. The cannabis industry is rife with fraudsters. The FDA is AWOL. 7. Many doctors are switching to concierge medicine, exacerbating physician shortages. Practices that charge sometimes hefty membership fees promise more personalized care, but the high costs and low patient volumes may limit access for everyone else. 8. How public health took part in its own downfall. This is a good little historical retrospective that brings us up to the present day and some of our challenge. 9. Nominees for a science award were all white men. Nobody won. A protest by a group of scientists has ignited spirited discussions about the persistent lack of diversity in such awards. And last but not least, 10. If Roe versus Wade fails, travel distance by state for people seeking abortion. Spoiler alert, it increases the distance needed to travel for an abortion a lot. You can look up for yours in other states by going online to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-